A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to dig into the two-axis political spectrum, that whole fiscal versus social mapping we all carry around in our heads. The basic assumption is that if you're conservative, you're conservative across the board. Low taxes and traditional values bundled together. Same for liberals. Progressive economics and progressive social policy. One package deal. But what happens when those clean mappings break? When a party is economically left, but socially conservative, or fiscally libertarian, but culturally liberal? Daniel wants us to look at the default positions first, then examine the movements that scramble them, especially in Eastern and Western Europe, where some of the strangest hybrids have taken power.
The timing on this is almost too good. You've got voters in France, Poland, Hungary, the EU, all choosing parties that refuse to sit neatly in one column. The old heuristic of, I know what a conservative government will do, is basically useless now. You have to check both axes independently, and most people aren't trained to do that.
Which is exactly why the two-axis model exists in the first place. It was designed to expose the fact that left and right are actually two separate questions that got smushed together by historical accident. And the smushing happened for a reason. The French Revolution literally seated people on the left and right sides of the assembly, based on their views about the monarchy. That physical seating arrangement hardened into a single spectrum, and we've been stuck with it ever since.
So let's establish the model. The two-axis political spectrum separates fiscal policy. That's taxation, government spending, regulation, the size of the state, from social policy, which covers civil liberties, family law, identity, tradition, religious alignment. The standard version was popularized by the Nolan chart, created by David Nolan in 1971. He was a libertarian who thought mainstream politics ignored a huge chunk of voters. His chart puts economic freedom on the x-axis and personal freedom on the y-axis. The insight was that liberal and conservative aren't two ends of one line. They're two independent dimensions that can combine in four different ways.
Nolan's whole project was to carve out space for the quadrant nobody was talking about, fiscally conservative and socially liberal, the libertarian quadrant. He was basically saying, hey, there are people who want free markets and also want the government out of their personal lives, and neither party represents them. Think of someone who wants to run a small business with minimal regulation, but also wants to marry whoever they want and smoke whatever they want on the weekend. That person has no natural political home in a one-axis system.
So you get four default positions. Quadrant one, fiscally conservative and socially conservative. That's your traditional right. Lower taxes, deregulation, traditional marriage, restricted abortion, strong national identity. Quadrant two, fiscally liberal and socially liberal. The traditional left. Progressive taxation, public health care, LGBTQ+ rights, secularism, expansive civil liberties. Those two are what most people picture when they hear conservative and liberal.
Those are the two that actually win elections in two-party systems, because they're internally coherent enough to hold a coalition together. There's a narrative logic to each. The right says freedom in markets, order in society. The left says regulation in markets, freedom in society. Each offers a consistent story about where freedom belongs and where constraint belongs. The interesting ones are the other two quadrants, which don't have that neat story.
Quadrant 3, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. This is what people usually call classical liberal or libertarian, free markets plus personal autonomy. The government doesn't tell you how to spend your money, and it also doesn't tell you who to marry or what to read. Quadrant 4, fiscally liberal and socially conservative. Sometimes called welfare chauvinism or national conservatism, redistributive economics, strong social safety nets, but paired with traditional values, restricted immigration, and cultural nationalism.
Here's the thing Daniel's really getting at. Those two mixed quadrants are where the political map gets genuinely weird. They're unstable in ways that tell you a lot about how power actually works, and they're unstable for different reasons, which is itself instructive.
Let's take quadrant three first, the libertarians. Libertarian Party was founded the same year Nolan published his chart, 1971, and in more than 50 years it has never won a single Electoral College vote. The high water mark was Gary Johnson in 2016, who got 3.3% of the popular vote. That's about 4.5 million people. Not nothing, but not remotely competitive.
The reason is structural, not just bad marketing. In a first-past-the-post system, a party that's fiscally conservative but socially liberal has no natural coalition partner. If you're a voter who cares most about low taxes, you can just vote Republican and hold your nose on the social stuff. If you care most about civil liberties, you vote Democrat and tolerate the spending. The libertarian position asks you to prioritize both axes equally, and that's a much smaller slice of the electorate.
There's a deeper problem, too. The two positions can actually conflict. If you want absolute personal autonomy, that includes the right to use drugs, to sell your organs, to engage in sex work, all things that free markets would happily provide. But many socially liberal voters are deeply uncomfortable with markets in those domains. They want personal freedom, but they don't want everything commodified. And the libertarian answer, commodify it all, let adults choose, ends up alienating the very socially liberal coalition they're trying to court.
There's a great case study here that illustrates the tension perfectly. In 2016, the Libertarian Party held its national convention, and during the primary debates, one candidate was asked whether he would have supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And he said no, because the Civil Rights Act forced private business owners to serve people they might not want to serve, which violates libertarian principles of freedom of association. Now, you can make a philosophically consistent argument for that position, but politically, it's suicide. You've just told every voter who cares about racial equality that your commitment to property rights trumps their commitment to basic dignity. That's the libertarian dilemma in a nutshell. Philosophical consistency keeps leading you to positions that are electoral poison.
It's not just one candidate, that's a recurring tension in libertarian circles. The same logic that says legalize drugs also says abolish the minimum wage. One of those is popular with the left, the other is anathema. So who's your coalition? You're trying to build a political movement out of people who agree with half your platform and hate the other half.
Which is why the Libertarian Party has spent 50 years as a kind of intellectual protest movement rather than an electoral force. It influences debates, the Cato Institute, Reason Magazine, the whole libertarian intellectual infrastructure, but it doesn't win seats. It's a reminder that being philosophically coherent doesn't make you politically viable.
Now flip to quadrant 4, and the story completely changes. Fiscally liberal and socially conservative parties have been surging across Europe for 2 decades. The Danish People's Party went from fringe to 21% of the vote in the 2015 Danish general election that made them the second largest party in Denmark. They combined generous welfare state spending with hardline immigration restrictions and cultural nationalism. You get to keep your health care and your pensions, and the state will protect Danish cultural identity. It's a powerful pitch. The welfare state as a national inheritance that belongs to us, not a universal entitlement that extends to newcomers.
Though here's the twist. By 2022, the Danish People's Party had collapsed to 2.6%.
The mainstream parties absorbed their positions. The Danish Social Democrats, traditionally center-left, adopted the DPP's immigration restrictions while keeping the welfare state. Once the major parties co-opt your signature issue, there's no reason for voters to stick with the niche party. It's a pattern we've seen across Scandinavia. The niche party does the risky work of normalizing a position, and then the establishment swoops in and takes the voters.
It's almost like the Quadrant 4 party serves as a kind of policy laboratory for the mainstream. They test drive the combination, prove there's an electoral market for it, and then get outcompeted by bigger brands with more resources. Which is actually a fascinating dynamic. Quadrant 4 parties can win big, but they're vulnerable to being cannibalized by the traditional parties they're trying to disrupt. The Sweden Democrats followed a similar trajectory, but managed to avoid the collapse. They went from 0.4% in 1988 to 20.5% in 2022, becoming the second largest party in Sweden. And they've done it by being disciplined enough that the mainstream parties couldn't easily absorb them without splitting their own coalitions.
The Sweden Democrats have roots that make absorption harder. The party was literally founded by neo-Nazi activists in 1988, which creates a contamination problem for any mainstream party trying to adopt their positions. If you're the Swedish Social Democrats, and you start sounding like the Sweden Democrats on immigration, your own base starts asking uncomfortable questions about who you're aligning with. The Danish People's Party had a somewhat cleaner break with extremism, which made their policies easier to borrow without the stigma.
We've got two mixed quadrants, and they behave completely differently. The libertarian quadrant can't win in two-party systems because it splits its potential coalition on both axes. The welfare chauvinist quadrant can win big in proportional systems, but it risks being absorbed if it succeeds too visibly. That's already a more interesting picture than left versus right.
It gets even more interesting when you move to Eastern Europe because the post-communist context flipped the whole mapping. In the West, economically left usually means unions, social democracy, maybe some nostalgia for post-war industrial policy. In Eastern Europe, economically left means something very specific. It means nostalgia for the communist welfare state, guaranteed employment, subsidized housing, cheap utilities, strong state intervention in the economy. But here's the thing, that economic nostalgia got fused with social conservatism in a way that doesn't map to anything in the Western experience.
Because the communist regimes were officially atheist and socially progressive in certain ways. Women in the workforce, state-run childcare, abortion legalized early in many Eastern Bloc countries. So when communism collapsed, the post-communist left had to figure out what to do with the social dimension. And in many countries, the answer was align with the Orthodox or Catholic Church and become socially conservative while staying economically interventionist. It's a fascinating pivot. The church went from being suppressed by the communist state to being the post-communist left's cultural partner. That's a realignment that makes no sense if you're only thinking in Western terms.
Poland is the cleanest example. The Law and Justice Party, PS, was founded in 2001 by the Kaczynski twins. By 2019, they won 43.6% of the vote, the highest vote share for any Polish party since the fall of communism in 1989. Their platform is a textbook case of Quadrant 4. On fiscal policy, they introduced the Rodzina 500 plus child benefit in 2016. That's 500 zloty per month per child, a massive expansion of the welfare state. They raised the minimum wage, lowered the retirement age, nationalized some industries, and increased corporate taxes.
On social policy, they went hard the other direction. The 2020 Constitutional Tribunal ruling restricted abortion to cases of rape or incest, or when the mother's life is at risk, effectively a near-total ban, since fetal anomaly had accounted for something like 98% of legal abortions in Poland. They pushed what they called family ideology, anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric, defense of traditional Catholic values, a whole narrative about protecting Polish children from Western gender ideology, plus a judicial overhaul that the EU spent years fighting them over.
The combination is what makes them so hard for Western observers to categorize. If you only look at the economics, they look like social democrats. If you only look at the social policy, they look like the religious right. But they're neither. They're a distinct political species that evolved in the specific soil of post-communist Catholic Poland.
Here's the thing. It's not just that they hold these positions simultaneously. It's that the positions reinforce each other. The child benefit isn't just an economic policy. It's a natalist cultural policy dressed in economic clothing. It's saying, we want more Polish children, and we'll pay you to have them. The welfare state becomes a tool for cultural preservation. That's a fusion that doesn't appear anywhere on Nolan's original chart. He treated the axes as independent, but Paez treats them as mutually reinforcing.
Voters seem to understand this intuitively. The Paez base isn't confused about what they're voting for. They want the state to protect them economically and protect them culturally, and they see those as two expressions of the same thing. The state as guardian. It's a paternalistic vision, but it's internally consistent in a way that the libertarian quadrant never managed to be.
Hungary under Fidesz is the same species, but with a twist. Viktor Orban came to power in 2010 and immediately started mixing signals. On the one hand, Fidesz introduced a 15% flat personal income tax in 2011. That's a classically fiscally conservative move, lower and flatter taxes. But at the same time, they imposed windfall taxes on banks, on foreign companies, on energy firms. They capped utility prices starting in 2013, direct state intervention in markets. They've nationalized pension funds and used the money to pay down debt.
Is Fidesz fiscally conservative or fiscally liberal?
They're economically nationalist. The flat tax applies to individuals, but foreign corporations get squeezed. The utility caps benefit Hungarian households, but punish foreign-owned energy companies. It's not a coherent fiscal philosophy. It's a strategy of using state power to reward domestic constituencies and punish external actors. The quadrant model strains to capture it, because Fidesz is operating on a different axis entirely, national versus foreign.
Which is actually a really important point. The two-axis model assumes that fiscal policy is one coherent thing. You're either for bigger government or smaller government. But Fidesz shows you could be for bigger government when it benefits your people and smaller government when it benefits foreigners. It's not inconsistent within their own framework. It's just that the framework isn't left versus right on economics. It's us versus them.
Orbán has been explicit about this. He calls it illiberal democracy. The state is democratic in that it represents the national will, but it's illiberal in that it doesn't respect the constraints that liberal democracies place on state power. Constitutional checks, minority rights, independent courts, those are treated as obstacles to the national will, not protections of it. Fidesz also amended the constitution to ban same-sex marriage and has pushed aggressively natalist policies, tax breaks for families with multiple children, loans that get forgiven if you have enough kids. The state literally pays you to reproduce the nation.
If PS is the cleaner example of Quadrant 4, Fidesz is the example that makes you question whether the quadrant model is even adequate for describing what's happening. When your fiscal policy changes depending on whether the recipient is Hungarian or foreign, you're not really on the fiscal axis at all. You've introduced a third variable that the model wasn't designed to capture.
Which brings us to Western Europe, where the new right parties have been deliberately repositioning to occupy Quadrant 4. Marine Le Pen's 2022 presidential platform is the clearest case. She proposed lowering the retirement age to 60. That's a fiscally left position, expanding state pension obligations. She also proposed nationalizing motorways and renationalizing some utilities. At the same time, she maintained hardline positions on immigration, proposed banning the veil in public spaces, and pushed a strong secularist nationalist cultural agenda.
This was a deliberate strategic shift. The old National Front under Jean-Marie Le Pen was more of a standard far-right party. Nationalism, anti-immigration, but not particularly interventionist on economics. Marine Le Pen moved the party left on fiscal policy specifically to capture working-class voters who had traditionally voted for the French Communist Party or the Socialists. She's trying to build a Quadrant 4 coalition from the right rather than from the left. It's the mirror image of what the Danish Social Democrats did. They moved right on immigration to capture nationalist voters. She moved left on economics to capture socialist voters. Both are converging on the same quadrant from opposite directions.
That convergence tells you something about where the electoral energy is right now. Quadrant 4 is contested territory precisely because it speaks to a real constituency, people who feel economically insecure and culturally threatened at the same time. That's not a small group in a globalized economy.
The two-axis model isn't just describing this, it's being used as a playbook. Parties now understand that if you're weak on one axis, you can reposition on the other to build credibility. Le Pen's economic left turn was partly about signaling to voters that she's not just a culture warrior. She cares about your pension and your electricity bill, too. And once you've established that economic credibility, the social conservatism becomes more palatable. It's a kind of political bundling strategy. Pair the controversial thing with the popular thing so voters feel like they're getting a package deal.
This is the performative dimension Daniel was hinting at. The two-axis model was designed as a descriptive tool. Here's where different political philosophies sit, but it's become a strategic tool. Parties use it to signal authenticity, to camouflage, to build coalitions that wouldn't naturally exist. They're reading the same charts we are, and they're using them to optimize their electoral positioning.
This creates a real problem for voters. The old heuristic was simple. If you know a party is left-wing, you can infer their positions on most issues. that heuristic is now actively misleading. You have to evaluate each axis independently, which requires more political literacy than most people have time for, and parties exploit that gap. They'll adopt one or two highly visible policies on one axis, nationalize the motorways, lower the retirement age, to earn trust, then use that trust to advance a much more radical agenda on the other axis.
It's almost like a bait and switch, except the bait is real. They do lower the retirement age. They do expand benefits. The economic policies aren't fake. They're the cost of doing business to get the cultural policies through. And voters who came for the pensions end up getting the nationalism as part of the bundle, whether they wanted it or not.
Let's step back and draw some practical lessons from all this. Daniel asked us to look at how these hybrid movements get defined, and I think we've mapped the territory. But what do you actually do with this information when you're looking at a ballot?
I'd say there are three actionable takeaways. First, explicitly separate the two axes when you evaluate any party or candidate. Don't ask, are they conservative or liberal? Ask two separate questions. What is their position on taxation and spending? What is their position on civil liberties and tradition? Treat them as independent variables until proven otherwise.
Second, be alert to axis switching as a rhetorical tactic. If a party that's been socially conservative for decades suddenly announces a bunch of economically left policies, ask why. Are they evolving, or are they trying to buy credibility on one axis to advance an agenda on the other? The same goes in reverse. A fiscally conservative party that suddenly discovers social liberalism might be trying to broaden its coalition without changing its core priorities.
Third, the two-axis model is a tool, not a truth. Real politics is messier than any quadrant chart. Parties often hold contradictory positions within a single axis, pro-free trade but anti-immigration, which are both fiscal, positions that point in opposite directions, or pro-public healthcare but anti-regulation. Use the model to spot inconsistencies, not to predict positions. The most interesting thing about a party is often where it doesn't fit.
The Polish PS is a great example of that. Within their fiscal axis, they're pro-welfare spending, but also pro-nationalization and anti-foreign capital. Those are different kinds of left, economics that don't always sit comfortably together. The model helps you notice the tension, but it doesn't resolve it.
That's actually the most useful thing a model can do. Make the tensions visible. Once you see that a party is trying to hold together a coalition that spans contradictory positions, you can start asking the right questions. Which faction is actually in control? What happens when the contradiction becomes too obvious to paper over? That's where the real political analysis lives. A model that gives you clean answers is less useful than a model that gives you better questions.
If the old map is broken and parties are actively gaming the two-axis model for strategic advantage, where does this go next? I think there's an open question that's worth sitting with. Climate policy is rapidly becoming a third axis, green versus growth. You already see this splitting traditional coalitions. The German Greens are fiscally center-left and socially liberal, but their climate positions put them in tension with industrial unions that want to protect manufacturing jobs. That's a three-dimensional political space, and it's going to scramble things even further.
There's another cleavage coming that might be even more disruptive. AI and automation are going to force a choice between universal basic income and job protectionism. Do we let technology displace workers and redistribute the gains, or do we protect jobs even if it means slower productivity growth? That cut doesn't map neatly onto existing left-right divides at all. You could have a coalition of tech libertarians and socialists supporting UBI for completely different reasons, while labor unions and cultural conservatives unite to protect traditional employment. The two-axis model won't just be inadequate, it'll be actively misleading.
Which would produce political hybrids that make PS and Fidesz look straightforward by comparison. Imagine a party that's fiscally conservative, socially liberal, pro-UBI, and anti-immigration. Where does that even go on a chart? The 2030s are going to be a weird decade for political taxonomy.
That's exactly the kind of thing Daniel loves to dig into. So if you're listening and you've got a political question that doesn't fit the standard categories, send it to us. This is what the show is for.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The São Tomé anchor bend, not long attributed to 15th century Portuguese navigators charting the Gulf of Guinea, was actually a misattribution corrected in 1987 when maritime historian Elsa Rivington demonstrated that the knot appears in a Greek merchant's cargo log from the 3rd century BCE, describing a lashing technique for securing amphorae aboard a Rhodes-bound vessel.
A Greek merchant's cargo log from the 3rd century BCE.
Hilbert, I don't know what to do with that information. Although, I suppose if a knot can be misattributed for 5 centuries, maybe our political categories are doing okay by comparison.
That's the spirit. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own weird prompt, maybe something about three-dimensional political spectrums, or Greek cargo knots, or anything else that keeps you up at night, go to myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.